Okay. Today is September 9th, 2021. This is an oral history interview with William or Bill E. Helms, who was a former operator at the SM-1A nuclear reactor facility at Fort Greely, Alaska. We are conducting this interview virtually over the phone today. We have two interviewers and one narrator. I am one of the interviewers. I'm Patience Stewart. I'm a historian, and I am calling from Portland, Oregon. Kevin, we'll go to you next.
Yes, hi, this is Kevin Taylor. I'm a health physicist and nuclear engineer calling from Greenville, South Carolina.
And Bill?
I'm William E. Helms, and known as Bill, and I'm in, where am I, Daly City, California, and ready to talk.
Great. Is William E. Helms the name that we should document for the interview, put on the website?
Well, at this time, yeah. Well, let's just call me Bill Helms and make it easy.
Okay. All right. Well, we can certainly call you Bill during the conversation, but if you'd like the official name on the recorded interview, we can do that as well.
No, it doesn't make any difference.
Okay. And what time frame did you work at SM-1A?
Well, I've been thinking back. I was sent up there, I think it was the refueling in 65. I just graduated from the nuclear reactor school, and I was in the training department, and I had the refueling in Alaska. They needed people, so they pulled me out of training and sent me up there, and I think it was 65. It was right after the big earthquake, and so I did the refueling there, and then I escorted the fuel back to Aiken, South Carolina. That was a 30-day train trip. Me and another guy and two gondolas full of nuclear fuel. That was quite a trip. Interesting times.
Could you tell us about what the refueling activities looked like? What all you did while you were there?
Well, again, I was fresh out of school, and I was more of a health physicist or technician, process control technician, I believe is what they called us. So I was basically covering with a radiation meter the boys working above the fuel, the reactor pressure vessel, and we were working with poles, about 20 foot long, pulling the fuel rods out and moving them over, then putting them down into a stainless steel shipping container that was, I don't know how many tons, but many tons. And then we'd load the container up, and all this was done underwater, about 20 feet of water. And you were working right over the pool. You know, you could fall in. We had safety ropes on and so forth. Back sometime, I think one guy did. Anyway, that's another story. But, so that's what I did, covered that. Then we loaded the fuel into, as I say, had it in these big humongous weighing stainless steel containers, at least 7 foot tall, I think. And we loaded them on low boys and carried them to, I think, Fort Greeley. And then we loaded them on in gondolas, railroad cars, and blocked them in for the voyage. And they hooked up a caboose to it, and me and this other guy, other HP, he was senior, Richard Cook, he's dead now. He and I went all the way. Well, we went to we go down to to the port, I think it was, and loaded onto barges, and they towed it down to up there, wherever you are, Portland, but the next city up there, the big one up there,
Seattle.
Seattle. And I came down, I flew down, and Richard went with the tugboat and these two gondolas on this barge, and him in the tugboat, and they pulled it down from Alaska to Seattle, and we offloaded the rail cars and hooked them on a train and took them across country in, say, about 30 days. Yeah. Right. The dangest thing, we'd wake up in the morning, and we'd be sitting out in the prairie, nothing in sight, just sitting on the side rail with a caboose and two gondolas of fuel, and it was a very interesting trip across America, let me tell you.
I bet it was just a different way to see the country, for sure.
Uh-huh.
And was the fuel returned to Virginia? Where did it go? Where did you end up?
Oh, I think it went to Carolina for reprocessing, and dropped, once we got there, we turned it over and went back to Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And then as soon as I got back there, I had orders to go back to Alaska for duty, for a tour duty up there. So I guess I was all right in their eyes when I was up there doing the refueling, so I got to go back, and I was real pleased about that.
Sure. Well, I would love to hear about what happened when you went back as an operator, as a health physicist, but I do have one more question about the refueling. Do you remember I assume that a new set of fuel was added back into the reactor? And Kevin, you could probably explain that more eloquently or clearly. But do you remember much about that process, Bill?
No, ma'am. I was not involved with that too much. I went with the spent fuel, and we took it, got on out there, and I went with that side of the program, getting the fuel back. So I did not, I don't believe, actually load fuel up there.
Okay. All right.
If I can interject for just a minute. So before you went to Fort Greely for the refueling, were you stationed at Fort Belvoir SM1 for a while, or did you go there from another facility?
I was stationed at Fort Belvoir. Once I went to the school, nuclear reactor school, I did go. I worked at that's where we trained at the plant out there. But once I graduated and got my basic operator's badge, I was assigned to the training department back up in the hill, and worked there for a few months before going to Alaska.
Do you know if that was a typical course of action for trainees? Did they become trainers before they became operators, or?
Well, it depends on how good a student you were, what your specialty was, and so forth like that. Some people went directly into training as instructors if they were, qualified. But that was more for the technical and the physics and so forth like that, the chemistry and the instrumentation, the mechanic specialty in each one of them. But, I was just, an extra HP, and so I was in training department. That was a good place for me, kept me out of trouble, and I had a few months there, then I went straight. A lot of my other buddies were sent straight to other reactors. We didn't have many reactors then, kind of think of it, but they went down and worked on the SM1 and so forth like that. Or I think one of them went out to Sundance, Wyoming. That was the one I wanted to go to, but I went to Alaska instead. I'm glad I did.
What made you want to go to Sundance?
Well, I went out there with this Navy chief for the program. I think Jerry spent more time under the ice than anybody. I think he took 5 tours to Antarctica. And anyway, he'd come back, was getting ready to train another crew, and he was going out to Sundance, and he took me along as more have somebody raised Kane with, and his family is out there. He was from Sundance, and that was one real adventure, going out there, seeing the Air Force plant, and then meeting Jerry's family, and Wyoming was a trip itself, and that was really great. Jerry Charette was probably one of the legends of the nuclear power program. He was one hell of a guy.
Well, you mentioned before that you're glad you were in Alaska. We spoke with one former SM1A operator who sounded like he might have had a different opinion to being at Fort Greely. Could you tell us about your time there and what you did or did not enjoy about actually being in that part of Alaska at that time?
one, it was pre-pipeline Alaska. I mean, it's wilderness out there. It was just a small post, Army Winter Warfare Training Center, and this little reactor out there in the nowhere. And so it was a wild and woolly west. And my first day after reporting in up there, I went out moose hunting and got freezer meat for the winter. And got a moose the first day. And so the hunting and fishing for me was one of the most wonderful things, to be able to go out and shoot a moose or go catch silver salmon, and you know, and but the beauty of working out in Alaska, after I qualified as an operator, that I went to health physics or the process control section and did most of that, the environmental monitoring and stuff and process control. And it was, you know, you had time off to go fishing and hunting. It was, if you liked to do that, it was wonderful. If you didn't like to do that, it would be awful miserable.
Such a beautiful place to do that in. Did you live on the base, or did you live in Delta Junction or Big Delta?
I lived on base. I was an E-5 when I reported in. I made E-6 up there after I became an operator. And I had enough rank. That was where one of my stories came in, having to pull a charge of quarters, you know, at night at the base on weekends like that. Somebody had to man the telephones at the base, and so I had to pull that, you know, once a month or something like that. And it was really great.
Were you married? Did you have family up there?
Yes, I had two children I brought up with me. One was 3, one was 5, and they still talk about it. We went out berry picking, and I had to watch the kids because the moose during rut season, they were pretty dangerous. And you never could tell what the buffalo would do. We had a herd of buffalo running around all the time, and you never could tell what they were going to do. And most of the time, they just run away, but every now and then, they'd run after you.
And was your wife with you as well?
Yes, she was. Yes, she was. It was pretty rough on the women up there, unless they were in the hunting and fishing, because they just, you know, there wasn't a lot to do on that small base. And, you know, going into the Fairbanks was a major, major trip. And everything was so expensive off base that, you know, you tried not to spend too much money off base if you could help it.
Got it. Now, what do you recall about your time at SM1A? Do you remember, you know, the day-to-day activities or any events that happened there?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty routine normally. Going in the morning, you had 3 shifts, and you go in and relieve the shift in the morning, and you go up and check operations, see what's going on, any problems, anything that need to be done maintenance-wise for the day. And you got your duties assigned, and you went around, did your routine tests and so forth, checked your gauges, recorded pressures, temperatures, and things like that, here, there, and yonder. And you go out and take your water samples here and there, and vegetation samples, soil samples, and you take, you know, process those samples for the records and make sure you weren't contaminating the environment. And it was, you know, that was what I did primarily. I qualified as operator, but I didn't pull that many shifts operationally. I was, I was a health physicist type, running around sampling and that type of stuff.
Anything happen up there while you were there that made you think, why am I working in a nuclear power plant?
Well, I guess one morning Sunday morning I got called in because said something was going wrong. They had a lot of activity on one of the radiation meters, one of the control room people did. So I was HP on duty. So I went in and took some samples of the secondary, and lo and behold, we had a spill and containment, primary to secondary leakage, and so we shut things down, and I don't think the plant ever went critical again while I was there. And I shipped out in, I think, late 66.
Do you recall where the leak was?
I was in one of the fuel rods in the, and then inside the pressure vessel. Mm-hmm. It was leaking, and it was going, getting into the primary water, and it was a mess.
We got up
to the steam generator.
How did the team respond? Do you remember what happened? How did your team respond? What were the next steps? Did you shut it down? You said.
Well, I called the control room, how I walked in there, it wasn't more than about 40 feet away. I walked there and said, hey, we got a problem. We got a leak. It's burning the radiation counter up. That's figuratively speaking. That was very high activity. So we had to be very careful from then on not to contaminate the equipment since this water was so contaminated. And so we had to go into a real more so than normal mode not to contaminate anything and be careful and see what the situation was. Fortunately, there was no real leakage outside the plant.
That's good to hear.
I've got an operational question for you. We've been helping the Corps of Engineers plan the decommissioning of the facility, mm-hmm. and there's a small building, a little Quonset hut, that is next to the reactor building. Was that there when you were there, and do you know of anything about the operations that took place in that building?
Well, I'm trying to, can you give me
the east side of the building.
Okay, let me orient myself here.
It'd be on the spent fuel pit side of the building.
Okay.
So just outside the door on the east side, a little metal Quonset hut.
And anything inside of it? Any
holes
in the ground?
There was a sump on one side. It was kind of divided into two rooms, north and south, and there was a sump on one side.
Uh-huh.
Just didn't know if you knew of anything.
That
waste management, waste handling, anything that went on in there?
I think we had some demineralizers in there to make sure to take anything out of the water that, you know, we couldn't filter out.
Mm-hmm.
I think, now, I don't quote me, don't hold me to it, you know, this was 60 years ago almost.
Sure.
Yeah, we had some of the demineralizers out there somewhere. Who was his name? Sergeant, the Major HP Sergeant. God, I knew it. Know his name better than anything. He taught me everything I know about health physics almost, you know, in the field. And Springer, Sergeant Springer. Oh, he's a hell of a good man. And I'm sure he's gone by now. Most of them are, I guess. But that might have been it, but it wouldn't have, the problem, it would have been if that's what it was, I believe that's what it was, something where the water went through a demineralizer. So I had some demineralizers out there.
Okay, thank you.
Did you survey the room any? Is it any contamination fixed or anything?
There's been some contamination identified in that building and some of the soil around it. That's on it. And the Corps of Engineers trying to figure out what might have gone on in there.
There were some demineralizers in there, and I was trying to remember for what they were. One of them was activated. It was hot.
Okay.
And because we had that was the room I had to wear one glove. One hand gloved and one foot bootied, and I'd hop back and forth across this line, you know, do it, cutting this off and that on and so forth like that. Sure. It was grins.
Could you tell me a little bit more about that, just not being in the field, in your field?
About what, ma'am?
About having one glove on and one glove off, and just explain that a little bit more.
That's something they taught you in school, you know, that, you know, you didn't want to contaminate your laboratory. You know, and if it was just you or somebody like you at your laboratory, you could set it up and basically have half hot, half cold, and a line drawn in the middle. And if you're cool, you'd put a booty on and have a gloved hand, and you'd hop in and do your stuff with your gloved hand as much as you could, and then you'd hop out and hop around your clean foot and clean hand, and kind of hop back and forth doing your stuff. And it was, and we didn't do that all the time. It was just some certain samples, and we had to do that in certain areas. But that was something they taught us in school. You could never do that today in around in reactors or something like that. That is a no-no. You'd have to have a strict control point and everything else. And no. We did things that you would never do today. I mean, if there wasn't anybody else to do them, so we had to do them.
Did you, your environmental samples you collected, did you handle those in the laboratory there in the reactor building near the control room, or was there another lab on the base?
That was the lab we had there then. It was a hot and cold lab, and hot end, one end, and separated off kind of with lines and so forth, and a lot of air intakes to keep stuff into the hot hot area. And but yeah, you'd never do that today. It was we were learning a lot, and as I say, if you had trained people, you could get away with it, but it's not something you could let untrained people into.
Right. Part of the, and Kevin, you may be able to describe this better, but at some point during the plant's history, it would provide heat for the laundry, the base laundry. Do you know if that was happening while you were there?
Well, when I was there, it was, we were discovering, not so much the laundry, but more the steam heat for the base. So I assume if it was steam heat for the base, it might have been steam heat for the laundry. I don't know that personally, but it's an assumption, since we were to provide steam heat some of the time.
And the steam heat for the base, did that involve a lot of interaction with the other half of the building, the
secondary? Yeah, it seemed, you know, we'd run the steam and the waste steam, and you dump that out into pipes to warm the buildings.
Got it. Why don't we back up and talk about the training a bit? Do you remember much about your time at Fort Belvoir, either as a student or an instructor, about the training program?
Well, you know, when I was as a student, I went through class, 1964, second class. And it was pretty high attrition rate. I think only one suicide. And that was my basic class. I think we had about 45 to start with. 30-something graduated. And Army, Navy, I think. Did we have maybe one Air Force? And they started us off. They said, this is not, we're not here to educate here. We are here to train you. And that's what they did. They trained us. We were not nuclear scientists. We were HP techs, glorified somewhat. And we learned how to drive rods and what to do when the reactor scrammed. And they gave us some good training in health physics and basic chemistry, water chemistry, for me. And the mechanics got some good training. The instrumentation techs were very well trained. I mean, you got the screening process for this for this school was so tight. I mean, it was number one, you had to be on your second tour. You had to be E5 and above, and you had to have 100 and you had to be in the top 5% of the Army in intelligence testing, and or the military. And so you got some really weird people who were, you know, very smart in a lot of ways, but so, all of us are kind of weird in one way or another. and they, kind of weird why we were there and not somewhere else. But there are a lot of stories involved. And so I was one of the smart ones. I got out, went back to school, and the rest stayed and became millionaires. And like, anyway,
what led you into the program? What made you decide to do it?
Well, I was in the cavalry. And I was in Colorado Springs and finishing up my first tour. And the GI Bill wasn't back into effect yet, so I didn't quite know what to do. I wanted to go back to school, didn't know how to afford it. And I was reading the Army Times, and on the front page it says, engineers are looking for trainees for this reactor training course. I said, well, hot damn, I've got all the qualifications for that. Hey, it sounded like something. Give me some training and so forth like that, and pay me to do it. And lo and behold, my new major came into my cavalry outfit, had just stopped at Fort Belvoir, and had met with a West Point friend of his who happened to be the colonel at our nuclear power training course. And so he wrote me a letter to the colonel back yonder in Belvoir and said, you know, I was a good person and, you know, gave my record and so forth. So I got in and it was cool.
Well, where did, you mentioned that, you know, you left the Army after, or at some point after your time at SM1A. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the time you left Alaska, then you left the Army, and then what did you do after that? And did your training and your experience, how did that impact the rest of your career?
Sure, you want to hear this? Well, let me say, I drove from Alaska to Texas, dropped family off, then I drove to Belvoir and got assigned to the Sturgis, the MH-1A floating reactor, which they were getting it ready to go to Panama. And they assigned me to the shift as an HP, and I qualified as an operator on it. Hated operations, I really did. And so they made me an HP, and then we all were working together to get her ready to go to Panama and doing a lot of deck work and so forth. And then she went towed down, and I flew down and became the environmental monitor for the Sturgis when she was parked next to the dam in Gatun Lake, the electrical dam there, and we were pulled up right next to it, and our power lines were put ashore and joined the dam's power lines, and we supplied power to the Panama Canal Company because there was a drought in Panama and they were trying to save water to run the ships through the canal. So that was our mission.
Wow. How long was that mission?
Let's see. I went down there. Let's see. I went down 767, 60. I guess I went down 68 right after they shot Kennedy. And went down there and then I came back in June, drove back from Panama to the States in June and got out of the Army on July 3rd, 1969. And when I said earlier that I was a smart one, well, the boys on my shift, Dale Ferguson, Bob Hess, and Vernon Haynes, they formed a company called Nuclear Support Services, who happened to be at Three Mile Island when the accident happened. And that's how I got called back into the nuclear field. But that's another part of the story. Anyway, so I went to the Sturgis and was an environmental monitor there, and really, it was probably the best job in the Yankee Army. I had access to a Jeep, a 14-foot aluminum boat with a 30-horsepower motor on it, and an LCVP with a coxswain. And I would cruise around Gatun Lake in these various vehicles and would get water samples, soil samples, and vegetation samples, and sometimes take air samples, and process these samples and enter them into the logbook and so forth. And that was my job. It was wonderful. Nobody told me what to do as long as I did my work.
That's great. So then, but after Sturgis, so you were, you did something else, but you got sucked back into the nuclear power industry, huh?
I drove back through Central America, saw all the Aztec ruins, and wanted to be an anthropologist. And, hold on, it's my other phone, just a second. Not important. Anyway, so where was I? I drove back and I went to the University of Texas and I got a degree in anthropology, and then I went off to Peru and thought I'd become a great explorer and looking for the Temple of Coropuna, and came back and figured I've got two kids ready to go to high school, I had to take a serious job, and so I went to work for the state of Texas Radiation Control Program on licensing industrial materials. And then in 79, Three Mile Island happened, and the phone rang and said, "Bill, we need you up here." And the old boys from the old ship called, and we had a reunion at Three Mile. And I worked a month up there under leave of absence from the state of Texas. And then I went back to Texas and started suffering cognitive dissonance on how much money I could make up there. And I really liked my job in Texas, but the pay was much better than being a nuclear consultant, and they seemed to accept me as one, so that's how I became a nuclear consultant.
So did you join the private company then, or were you a consultant?
Oh, yeah, I was part of back and joined Nuclear Support Services and ran a job site for them in Louisiana, and stayed with them. Good boys, and they made a lot of money, and I'm proud of them. And so I lost touch of them when I took a job in Kansas after I went, a different company. I went to work with Intel up in Kansas, but Wolf Creek. But yeah, that's how I got to become a nuclear. Well, let me finish the story here. I'm going to branch a little bit. Back in my Army training, we saw a movie called the SL-1. I mean, SL, what's it, SL, no.
Yeah, SL-1, the accident in Idaho.
Yeah. And that so impressed me. And it's just, I always try to show it when I taught emergency planning, at least to the techs and so forth, and get them a little bit creepy-fied, you know, and let them, you know, see, it can really happen, and people do or can die. And anyway, for some reason, everybody thought I was an emergency planning specialist, and I would write scenarios and stuff like that for, and anyway, that's what I did for reactors, so. And, train the techs on how to respond to an accident. And that's the important thing, is to get them, you know, get control of it early on.
So did you stay in the nuclear industry then till retirement?
Yeah, I did. I worked for, Rancho Seco, and I saw that she wasn't going to start up again. I left them and went and worked for the Department of Energy and got so disappointed with them. I started my own little company decommissioning and decontamination specialist here in California, and decommissioned a lab down in L.A., big mess down there. And then I worked out at Livermore. I was called out there to consult a little bit, and on emergency planning type stuff for the national labs. They didn't have an emergency plan back then. So I helped them then with emergency plan. And that was, when I say Livermore, at Sandia, I had Livermore. And so I about that. And then I started the radon testing business, and I ended up kind of retired about 60. I mean, in 2000. Yeah, I think it's
about which laboratory did you decon down in the L.A. area?
Somebody was trying like hell to get a hold of you. Just a second.
Sure.
Hello. I'm speaking, but right now, Carol, take this phone call. I'm on a long-distance call right now. Can you excuse me and talk to my wife? She has my permission to talk to you, please. Hi, I'm back.
Great.
Okay. Yeah, I was involved on a decommissioning project down in the Los Angeles area. It was a pharmaceutical lab several years ago.
Oh, was it a new one? It wasn't cleaned up when I left, was it?
It was called ICN, I believe was the name of it. This was probably 20 years ago, though. But so it sounds like I've actually been on the Sturgis myself before.
Oh,
they,
really?
They,
cool.
They decommissioned it. Through work with the Corps of Engineers, I've been to the PM1 reactor in
Antarctica,
in Wyoming.
Oh,
and
Antarctica.
I've been to SM1 and SM1A as well. So
I've been around.
I've been around to those. Yes, sir.
Don't call me sir, son. Unless you're talking to Granddaddy. Anyway, yeah, I'm glad to see. I'm sorry to see old Sturgis go. She demonstrated that we do need some plants now that we can pull all these disaster areas and give them some power. God, that's amazing. Anyway, don't get me started.
So, with a long career in the nuclear power industry, do you recall much of the either the popular opinion around nuclear power at the time, or maybe your family and friends and their comments on?
Well, let me tell you, when I was riding that train across the country in a caboose, me and this one old boy, we had, I think, an old 45 pistol, I don't know if it would work or not, 7 rounds of ammunition, and we had the spent core of SMO, Alaska, and these two gondola cars. And we would drive through these little towns out in West Texas, not West Texas, but in Plains up north. And they have barriers down to keep the traffic off the road. And you go through a little town about 10 miles an hour and people looking at you. And they see all these radiation signs on these gondola cars. And you just see their faces kind of go from, oh, I'm sorry, I'm waiting here at the train stop, and oh my God, what am I doing here? And that got moved out the other direction in a rapid manner. And that was interesting. But most people really didn't know that much about it, and it wasn't until Three Mile happened that you really got people spooked, and that was sad because, nobody died there. It was a mess in a lot of ways, but nobody was killed. Or even hurt, that for that matter. I don't recall whether it fell down a ladder. But that was my biggest problem at Three Mile, was fear, fighting the fear. The radiation alarms in that riverbed, the Susquehanna River, in the mornings, about 4 or 5 in the morning, the radon would be coming out of the riverbed and would set off the radiation alarms outside of Three Mile Island. And you could hear the radon going, getting heavier and heavier by the radiation alarms moving down alongside the plant. And try to explain that to a steel worker trying to, connect up a demineralizer or something like that. You're having to work up a long, narrow steel ladder, and they don't know that. And you're standing up there trying to stop 20 men charging at you, and trying to tell them, whoa, we spent an hour getting dressed out to come in here. We don't want to run out now, do we? And it was a real battle. I guess that was probably the hardest thing I did up there, was keep people calm down and try to calm, keep them cool. I say, when I run, that's when you get scared. First law of health physics.
And you said you were, your official role there was as a safety monitor?
I was a health physicist for the, well, things were all mixed up there between who's a contractor and PG&E and so forth. Like, I was a contractor, but I was in charge of about, at night from about, I'd go on work about 6, and I'd work 17 hours a day up there, and I had all the HPs at night. I think they were all mostly nuclear support service people, contractor HPs, and but yeah, I was in charge of, keeping the peace and keeping the workers protected at night. And thankfully, I wasn't in charge when they burned down the outhouses, but that's another story.
Now, you've spoken a bit about some close relationships that you've had with other people in the program. Do you think you could speak a little about the culture and camaraderie of the Army Nuclear Power Program as a whole?
Well, yeah. The Navy was a lot closer, because when you were, most of them were CBs, and our corpsmen, and the CBs only had about 3 or 4 battalions at the time, and they stayed with each other through the whole, most of their career, whereas the Army, most of us came in there from various programs, and then we'd go off into our specialties and off to our different plants, and then most of the Army guys, or a lot of the Army guys, got out right afterwards and went back to school, the younger ones, like me. And but yeah, basically, anybody from the program, you knew automatically what his training was and what to expect of him. At least that's the way I always felt, that you could trust him. If you knew, if he'd gone through the program, you could trust him. Mm-hmm. And that's the best thing I can say about anybody.
Absolutely. Are you still in contact with anyone from the program?
One or two, most of them are dead, and I think probably all dead. Jerry's still alive. I think he's out in Wyoming, last I heard. I saw him at one of our reunions out there, the last one we had in Deadwood. And but I spoke about it then. Most of the guys, they were Navy, and they were, served together even when weren't in the nuclear program, and they were a lot closer than the Army guys were. But, as I say again, of anybody that went through that program, I trust them. As I can say of anybody.
I heard that same thing. I was involved in some of these interviews for SM1 as well, and I spoke with several of the former operators there and instructors and folks that went through the program, and they said the same thing. It was about people, especially people that were working in the nuclear industry afterwards. If they saw a resume that came through and they were trained within the Army reactor program, they didn't need an interview. You're hired.
Well, that's what happened to me when I got out and I went up to the state of Texas right before I went to college and see if I could go to work for him as a health physicist. And one of our Air Force types was there as head of the Texas program, and he was highly respected. Anyway, they told me, he said, we'd love to hire you, but you have to have a degree. So I went back, got a degree. Of course, time I came back, he was dead and a new guy, but he hired me right away, and there was never had any problem getting hired doing anything once they saw the credentials in the program.
Pretty elite and specialized team.
Well, we felt so.
So your anthropology career was relatively short-lived, huh?
Yes, it was. I did spend 6 months in the Andes crossing them on a horseback with my wife looking for this damn temple, but it's something. I'm glad I did. It's the dumbest thing I ever did in my life, but I'm glad I did it. you got to do something dumb once in a while, and my wife's about half crazy anyway, so it was good. And this is my new wife anyway, so it's been a good life, but the Army Power Program, it stood me well all my life, and everybody in it, I respect everyone I knew in it, and the men that I say, especially older guys, these are guys that from World War II in Korea, and they you can tell they were very sharp dudes, but never had a chance at education and so forth. But then I learned a lot from these people, and the biggest thing was when I say I got a moose my first day in Alaska. Well, the guy I was living with and sharing the house with got one too, and his was a big one. I just got the big anyway. Couple of guys from the plant drove up, and next thing you know, we had six guys from the plant, didn't even know half of them. They helped us clean and quarter the moose and get it out of there, and I didn't know how to do that. And so they were good people, let me tell you. They were, especially the wild ones up in Alaska. Oh, those were back to nature dudes. And one of them had a plane. Did you ever hear about the guy that had the airplane?
I have. Tell us.
Well, yeah, one of the operators in Alaska, he was a civilian. They had a surveillance operators up there. You remember, know that?
Yes, and we are going to interview someone from that group next week.
Okay. Yeah. If I knew his name, I might remember it. Anyway, one of them was, he was an operator. He was a pastor of a little church, and he had a little plane. And he flew me and another guy way back in the woods to go bear hunting one time. I was going with the other guy. I have no need to shoot a bear. I've avoided it several times in Alaska, but anyway, I was going as a backup for him. And this guy flew us and landed us up there, and we got snowed in, and he couldn't come get us. And thankfully, our old buddy from the Army Northern Warfare Center drove an armored personnel carrier across the snow and rescued us and brought us back out to a base camp where they could helicopters back to go to work.
Wow. That's quite a story.
Yes, it is.
That was Alaska. That was just the way it worked.
By chance, was his name George Shaw?
And I remember the name George Shaw, but that wasn't him.
Okay.
Now, the guy that had the plane was a pastor, and he was civilian. And George, know him, and had a little church up there. And a lot of the guys stayed up there. Of course, they're probably all dead now, but they homesteaded and things like that. And I don't know, one winter in Alaska was enough for me.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your time at SM1A or Fort Greely?
Well, I fell through the ice once. That was an experience.
Where
I went
was
out
that?
In the mornings. I used to go out. There was a little lake not far from the post, and I'd drive out and light a little fire in the frying pan and have a little butter and flour, and I'd cast out in this pond, and he's grayling and hitting my lure, and I'd pull him in and clean him and fry him up right there for breakfast. And so later on, when the winter came, I wanted to go out and try to catch him through the ice. And I went out and I cracked a little bit. But I thought, well, it's probably okay, but I better test it. And so I jumped on it and fell right through it. Thankfully, it was only about 4 feet deep, but by the time I got to shore, and it was, 40 below, and by the time I got to shore, I think all the veins on the outer part of my body were frozen by then. Managed to get home and get in a hot tub for about 3 hours, and finally got my feeling back. But, Lord, you never want to fall through the ice. It is not good.
Wow.
You really tested it by jumping on it.
Did I tell you that when I roped the moose?
No.
I haven't told us that one either.
Tell us.
Well, this was when I was in Fairbanks on the caboose waiting for the ship out of there. This young bull moose walked by the caboose, and I sat up in the out top window looking out, and I had this radiation rope, and I just, you know, being stupid, just threw it out over his neck, and you know, Texas boy, and pulled it, and yahoo! And next thing you know, I was almost through that window being jerked out. They are strong. And anyway, I got the rope off him eventually, but don't rope bull moose. That is not smart.
Well, we appreciate the lessons.
But Alaska was a different place up there, and it was so wild. God, it was wild. Anyway, and the people were pretty wild in Fairbanks. But, yeah, memories.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to share some of these memories with us and talk about your time in the program.
I wish I could have been more serious, but I had a wonderful time.
It sounds like
and I did. I always was good on my work. You know, I did good work. Even my bragging, I always did good work. Oh, one story. One of my first lessons I learned in Alaska, the water in the Tanana River was more radioactive upstream than it was downstream from us. And you know why? Because the cooling water we were throwing into it that were from wells was cleaner than the Tanana River as far as radiometrics.
Mm-hmm.
And,
interesting.
That kind of freaked me out. But I actually saw it, you know, and did legitimate measurements. But Sergeant Springer, you know, verified it. He said, yep. He said, now you know. We're cleaning up Alaska. But anyway, nobody liked that story. But, it's true.
Kevin, do you have any more questions?
I do not, but I certainly have enjoyed listening to your stories, and sounds like you've had a great career in the nuclear industry, and
well, what you probably remember up there is the radiation meters we had to wear them inside our parkas. To keep the batteries warm.
Oh, yeah.
It's cold outside. And,
did that make it tougher to monitor them?
Well, it's hard to use a machine when you got frozen batteries and if you ain't got spares. So, yeah, I found that out. We had a truck carrying this empty fuel cask up to Alaska arrived and contaminated the base. Had to dig it out and then trail it back all the way, the rail car all the way back, I don't know how many miles back, and survey everything and make sure it wasn't contaminated. But the meters kept freezing up. It was rough. It was rough out there when it was that cold. And you know, it was a lesson I learned. Keep your batteries, keep your meters inside your parkas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to think about that today, even when we're going into, I've experienced that myself in cold areas where the battery life, whether it's your radiation detector or your cell phone, batteries don't last long when they're cold.
Yes, sir. That's true. And anyway, that's the last of my story. So if I can be of any help in any way, please call me and I'll try to help.
Well, this has been very helpful. I think that having your story shared in the Alaska Oral History Program, I think will be a great benefit.
Well, I hope it helps. As I told you, you know, about 10 years ago, I tried to go back up and see the site, and they wouldn't let me off base. As civilian guards, it really made me mad. All right.
If you want to get back up there in the next few years, I'm sure you reach out to the Corps of Engineers project manager, and I'm sure they'll help you out.
Yeah,
well, I appreciate that, sir. I doubt if I'll get back up there. I'm getting too old, but it was fun to drive up there again. It was, you know, I love the country.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Y'all too. Have a good day and good weekend now.
All right. Thank you again for your time and for your service to the program.
I got the release form today. I'll put it in the mail.
Okay, great. Wonderful. And I will be in touch with you about a bio and a photo for the website.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.